GLP inhibitors like Ozempic and Wegovy clearly do a great job at helping folks lose large amounts of weight. But there's emerging evidence that the benefits go well beyond achieving a healthy weight. And then there's the dark side. Can they also do harm? I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. A few months ago, I did an episode on the GLP-1 inhibitors with Dr. Kathleen Jordan, and she went through what the GLPs are, how they work, how well they work, the basics. So I usually would not return to the same topic so soon. But new information coming out about the GLP-1 inhibitors has exploded, and I have a lot more questions. So my guest today is Dr. Alexandra Sowa, an internist who's certified in obesity medicine and the author of the just-published book, The Ozempic Revolution, A Doctor's Proven Plan for Success to Help You Reverse Obesity and Yo-Yo Dieting and Protect Yourself from Disease. Welcome and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So this is the thing. You know, whenever I do a podcast on a topic that is outside my area of expertise, and this is outside my area of expertise, I always like to pull some recent research to get me up to speed, know what to ask and all that. So about a week ago, I went to our medical search engine, PubMed, and I put in GLP-1 drugs 2024. More than 3,300 articles popped up. Yeah. I mean, think about that. Over 3,000 published articles in 1 year. And just to compare, just for the heck of it, I put in another commonly prescribed drug, Lipitor, and there were, you know, a few hundred. So does that surprise you? And how do you keep up with it all?
No, it does not surprise me. I am dedicating time every day to go through new studies. Right before we popped on today, there was a big announcement by Novo Nordisk. You have to weed through some of it. Why we're seeing so much research being published is because these medications are not just for, we're finding, for the primary indications of blood sugar management and weight loss, but they have these significant impacts on downstream health effects from obesity and inflammation.
Exactly. And that's what I want to focus on. I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're just studying it. And it's great to see the research dollars being put into it because we can validate where we are able to use this drug most efficaciously. I wrote the book, really, a part of the section is going through the research and breaking it down for people because we're constantly hit by these new clickbaity headlines and you do need to know what this is. And I try to make it as easy as possible.
Yeah.
And as you said,
and you need to get that information from an expert. I mean, let's be clear. There's a lot of information out there on, well, TikTok is about, by the time we tape this, I mean, by the time this goes live, TikTok may be obsolete, but you know what I mean. They're out there and there's just so much misinformation. Okay, but given all that, I mean, let's think about this. Every 10 minutes, there's a new article, there's a new study, there's a new finding. And yet, you know, you wrote this book about the GLP-1s, and this is kind of brave of you as an author. You know, we always worry about when is our book going to be out of date. So are you concerned that your book is going to be obsolete in 10 minutes?
No, because I have been using these medications for well over 10 years. They have been out in the world since 2005, even though we're just talking about them now. And my book is not just an overview of the science of the benefits of these drugs. It's how to thrive and understand the whole process, specifically the biology of weight gain. And so the book, while we go through all the studies and talk about the science, it really is a framework for how to be successful and not just lose weight or get your blood sugar in check, but to optimally gain health.
Yeah.
And that's
what I loved about the book.
The same. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And when I was reading the book and I thought, this is really just a guide to why you want to maintain a healthy weight and how to maintain a healthy weight, which of course goes beyond just taking a drug. So we are definitely going to circle back to that in a little bit. But so before we get going with all of this, I mean, I did have this other episode, but probably people don't remember that. It was a little bit ago, and I think it's worth reviewing this a little bit. So could you just quickly go through what are these GLP-1s and how do they work in the body? What makes them work so well? To lose weight specifically. We'll get to the other stuff, but just to lose weight.
So GLP-1 medications are a synthetic version of a hormone that naturally exists in our body and is secreted by our gut. why they are so much more successful than what we make natively is because they have a very long half-life. And as opposed to our own GLP-1 hormone that fades away after a few minutes, these medications last up to a week and beyond, actually. They last longer than that, but the strong efficacy is 7 days. They work on three levels: at the level of the brain, at the level of the gut and the stomach, and at the level of the pancreas. And this is what I call their three superpowers. And by talking to the brain, we quiet food noise. We're not constantly thinking about food. In the gut, the food that we eat sits there longer, giving positive feedback back to our hormones for fullness. And at the level of the pancreas, which is probably where we're seeing the biggest health benefits, it helps us be more sensitive to the insulin that our pancreas secretes and very quickly grabs up blood sugar that is pro-inflammatory, pro-weight gaining, and neutralizes it. So these medications are not just appetite suppressants. They are not just helping us eat less. There is a very whole body response. We have GLP-1 receptors all over the body, and this is why we see such incredible health benefits from them. It's important to say that we have more hormones coming out. So GLP-1 is one of the main satiety, fullness, hunger hormones that we have. The second round of drugs, tirzepatide, doesn't just have GLP-1, it has GIP. There is a new drug that will likely be coming out as an entrant in the market at the end of this year or early next year, called retatrutide. It will have three hormones in it. GLP-1 seems to be needed as a base for these medications, but we've really started to crack the code on how to help our hormonal dysfunction that has developed and led to such overwhelming obesity in this
Yeah.
country.
I mean, that's such an important point because most of the drugs that have come to market over the last decade or so have just simply been appetite suppressants, but they're really not changing the way the body metabolizes food. And, we talk about this with other hormones all the time, that estrogen receptors are throughout the body. It's not just in the reproductive organs. And I think that this is a theme that we're going to start hearing a lot more about, not just with your hormone and my hormone. Can we take ownership of those hormones? Is that okay? But it's not just going to be with our hormones. It's going to be with a lot of other hormones, which of course is going to help us figure out how to deal much more effectively with many other medical conditions beyond just people who have obesity or who have, low estrogen problems. So it's really so interesting.
I think there's such a great relationship between estrogen replacement, and I think we should start calling it GLP-1 replacement, because people often will say, well, why do you have to keep taking this medication? If you stop it, does the weight come back? And you have to explain it. Well, we're replacing something that has gone totally missing in your body naturally, and you're going to keep needing it to have the long-term benefits. So I really like this relationship between the two.
No,
I think they are good partners.
I think that you're absolutely right on with this because I talk all the time about this idea that you take your estrogen therapy while you're having hot flashes for the 7 to 10 years, and then you go off and it's like, okay, but what about your bones? What about your joints? What about all these other things? Your vulva, vagina, on and on and on. See, I have to say vagina once in every episode. It's kind of a rule. So now I've got that out of the way. But it's really it's the theme is so important. The other thing I want to ask you about is so often people are told that they should take a GLP-1 based on their BMI. But the whole concept of the BMI as an indication of if you're a healthy weight is become very controversial. And you do talk about that in the book. Can you talk about it a little bit right now?
Yes. So the concept of how we should define obesity and excess weight that's affecting our health is evolving, and this is changing. I lay out the BMI criteria because right now insurance covers
We're stuck with that.
everything based on BMI. Really, though, what we need to be looking at is body fat composition and distribution of body fat, and really looking at the whole of metabolic health. I lay this out in the book. I think there is a big piece missing for many people who are getting access to this medication right now. They are totally skipping over a metabolic health assessment. We need to understand where we're starting to see how this drug is helping us. So things like looking at fasting insulin, hemoglobin A1C, fasting glucose, looking deep in our cholesterol markers and understanding, do we meet criteria for metabolic health? Majority of US Americans don't. In fact, only 12% of American adults are fully metabolically healthy. So we need to know, are we treating metabolic dysfunction or are we just treating weight? And really, there should be an overlap.
Let me interrupt you for a second because I have a question. I don't prescribe GLP-1 inhibitors. It's out of my wheelhouse. But the people that are prescribing, aren't they looking at that stuff before they
No.
write a prescription? That's kind of shocking.
I would say, unfortunately, a lot of what I'm seeing out in the world is asynchronous care for getting access to these medications, meaning it's we're logging into an app, you request it, you put in these BMI markers, and then you get it in the mail. The beautiful thing about these medications is that actually, I don't. They're very safe. They really are very safe. And we don't have to check a lot of baseline labs to make sure you're a good candidate, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be, that we're not doing
Yeah.
holistic care if we just send you a script in the mail. So that's why I wrote this book, because these injections, these medications are not a magic wand for health. They can be the most amazing tool to help us achieve health, but we need to be looking at all facets of it.
Yeah. I heard a lecture a couple years ago about this whole BMI controversy. And the point of the person who was giving the talk was that there's certain ethnicities in particular, such as Black women, that are told that they're not healthy based on their BMI, when in fact that's not true. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I write about this in the book. So, ethnicity is a very misunderstood component of BMI. We have lower and higher cutoffs for different ethnicities. And again, this is why we need to be looking at the whole person and not just a calculator. I mean, this calculator, all it takes into account is your weight and your height, and that is it. And it's a good screening tool, but it really isn't getting to the root of if you're healthy or not. Because of that, in this instance of Black American women, people just often don't listen to this. They just say, well, I'm not going to hear anything about weight. And unfortunately, that has increased rates of prediabetes, heart disease. We need to kind of meet people where they are, and it shouldn't just be about the way a body looks or distributes weight or where we fall on a BMI calculator.
All right, so let's talk about other health benefits that are attributed to these GLP-1 uses. And this is what I want you to do as we kind of go through these things. There's a difference between there being a benefit because of the weight loss versus there being a benefit specifically because of what is happening in your body with the GLP-1s, how it's changing things. And I think that that's really an important thing to talk about, because when we talk about it cutting down on heart disease, which we know it does, is that because people have lost weight, which we know is going to decrease their risk of developing cardiovascular disease? Or if someone is of a normal, healthy weight, but is at risk for cardiovascular disease, are they potentially going to benefit in terms of having prevention of atherosclerosis and all of that down the road? Do we even know the answer to that? So let's talk about cardiovascular stuff. That is the number one thing that kills women. So I do want to focus on that a bit.
So we see decreased risk of stroke, heart attack, all-cause mortality in patients who have pre-existing heart disease and obesity. Now, the improvement in all of these metrics is independent of weight loss. We do see benefit because remember, the GLP-1 receptors are all over our body. So we have it in our heart, in our endothelium, and we're seeing improvement everywhere. We do not have the answer yet for whether you, if you are at a normal weight, whether we should be just preemptively starting these meds, but it is being studied.
It's interesting. And I thought, okay, the ones that we should study are the celebrities who don't really need to take this.
That's
But that's not going to happen. I'm just throwing that out there. All right, let's keep going down the list. Kidney health. I read that that there may be benefit in terms of protecting kidney health down the road. But can you tell us about that?
Yes, and it is both from both weight loss and independent of weight loss. So
Okay.
we specifically see this in the type 2 diabetes population, but beyond, and it just makes a lot of sense again because of GLP-1 receptors and decreasing inflammation and chronic disease development everywhere.
Yeah. And of course, when we look at kidney health, people who have diabetes are at very high risk
Yes.
for developing kidney disease down the road. Let's talk about the brain, neurologic health. Is this neuroprotective?
Yes, it very much appears to be. And I predict within the next 10 years, we will have an FDA indication for taking these medications for dementia prevention in specific subsets of people. It is too far to call that yet, but this is what my gut feels. We see significant decreased inflammation and neuroprotective benefit. And again, it's hard to really dissect out both the weight loss versus independent. We are seeing it both. Fat, and I talk about this in the book, fat is very pro-inflammatory. It's a very, very powerful organ. It is not just a nuisance that doesn't allow you to fit into your clothes. And so when we are able to reduce the burden of fat to muscle in our body, we see overall decreased inflammation, but we all are also seeing independent neuroprotective benefit.
Just fascinating. Obstructive sleep apnea,
So this
which
one does have to do more with weight. Then independent of weight, you can be a thin person and still have sleep apnea, depending on central apnea or the way that your mouth and the back of your throat is. So with this one, we really are seeing it tied to weight loss.
The liver one I think is interesting because there's been some studies showing that there's a decrease in liver inflammation, but there's also a lot of studies, as I hope confirm that people drink less when they're taking the GLP-1 inhibitors for a variety of reasons. So is the benefit to the liver a direct result, or is it because people are drinking less? What do you think?
No. So the liver is, it really has nothing to do with drinking.
Okay.
Let's talk about drinking for a second. Back to the cognitive benefit of these drugs. We talked about the superpower is that our brain is positively affected by these medications. The same part of our brain that has an unhealthy relationship to food has that same unhealthy relationship to alcohol and drugs and other addictive behaviors, even like shopping.
Oh
So
no.
I've had patients report
Boy,
they
I
shop
think I'd
less.
rather not know that. I don't know that I want to
But
stop my shopping addiction. Whoa.
when it comes to alcohol, this is very well studied at this point. In the Ozempic revolution, I talk about these emerging benefits, including this. We are now studying it for opioid addiction. It's the same part of the brain that becomes dysregulated hormonally that keeps us coming back for things that don't help us. When we talk about liver benefits, we are seeing very clearly decreased inflammation, primarily from insulin resistance and better control of our blood sugar that helps the subunits of the liver do their job without getting junked up and creating inflammation at the hepatocellular level. I love this because people don't realize that fat in the liver, inflammation in the liver, outpaces. When we think about cirrhosis, we think of alcoholism and harming your liver that way. But we can do the same process by just having excess fatty deposits in our liver from excess weight. And this is really overtaking, and it's a big problem in this country. So I love this one. It doesn't get talked about enough. It's a big
The other thing
benefit.
also that's really of interest to me is it's one thing to talk about addiction, people who really have a problem with alcohol. But is it also the case that people who don't have a problem with alcohol, they just, are regular drinkers, that they have a couple of drinks a night or and that they suddenly notice a significant reduction? I mean, anecdotally, I have a lot of friends who are taking these drugs, who are the people whom we go out to eat. They're the ones that have two or three glasses of wine, and suddenly it's like, I don't really want any, or maybe I'll just have one.
Yes, we do see that both subjectively and objectively reported that people just don't have the craving. They just don't get the same dopamine hit from it, so they don't want it. And we do know that alcohol, even in small amounts, can have a negative downstream effect. So it's
Well,
another pro on the pro list of
another
this
pro list. I mean, yeah,
medication.
we've been talking a lot about alcohol lately because of the Surgeon General's recommendation to put the label with the warning saying that it's associated with seven kinds of cancer. And I've actually been writing about that a lot on my Substack column and getting people's reaction. And I had a poll to see if this was going to make people cut down. And actually, a lot of people said, yeah, I'm going to
That's
stop
great.
drinking or I'm going to cut down. So it is having an impact. Going along the theme of impact on the brain, what about depression? People that have depression, has that been shown to help with that? And again, separating it from people who might be having issues with mood or depression because they're concerned about having obesity versus just depression.
So this is a little bit of a trickier one. Large population studies show that yes, actually, there is overall decreased risk of anxiety and depression on these medications. Would I say that it should be a first-line treatment? Absolutely not, because the relationship with food is complicated. And I talk about this in the book, but something that I don't see reported on is generally I have patients who, when we treat them with GLP-1s, if you take away their primary source of comfort and joy, which for many people is food and alcohol, they experience something I'll call it anhedonia, which is just a subtle lack of pleasure when it comes to life. And I really make my patients aware of this. This is not common, but I have seen it. And we need to work through on a cognitive behavioral therapy level, and sometimes with therapy and sometimes with psychiatry, breaking through this. This is not a cause of the medication, but I would say that we have to be on the lookout for
Well,
it.
it's part of the whole holistic approach, which is what
Exactly.
you're about. But to me, the real benefit is not that it decreases depression, but it doesn't increase depression. You know,
And
so
that's
often with a new drug, you're like, okay, but is it going to impact on my issues with depression or anxiety they already have? And I think there's good data that shows that that's not the case.
You're absolutely right. And I probably should have answered in the affirmative first, because we see these clickbaity headlines that say increased risk of suicidality or depression. That is not true. And that has proven to not be true. And in fact, for the majority of users who are on this medication, will say the quality of my life and my mental health has improved so dramatically. And we do not see a negative link in any way, shape, or
Yeah.
form.
But I also hear that there may be an association with psoriasis. This is early data. So, any thoughts on that?
I think we're going to continue to see reduction and improvement in diseases that are linked to inflammation. I think
Yeah.
we have become a very inflamed country,
We
and
do.
this drug is
I'm
helping
particularly
relieve that.
inflamed right now about a number of things, but
Yeah.
that's.
Yeah, maybe you should be on a GLP-1.
Yeah,
No.
I don't
But
know.
I think the research is just going to continue to emerge, and that's why there are so many articles that you found in PubMed, your
Right.
PubMed search.
Okay. And then finally, as far as potential benefits, the big one, is this going to decrease your risk of cancer?
Well, we already have seen that it does. And
But again, obesity is
obesity.
associated with many kinds of cancer. Of course, you know,
Right.
we were looking at breast, we're looking at uterine, you know, in my world. So is there an independent decrease in cancer, or is it because of the decrease in obesity? Or we don't know.
I bet it's a little bit of both. What we have been able to prove thus far is it's linked to reduction in obesity. And it's
Yeah.
really important to state here that we, because these drugs are so different than previous weight loss and independent of other studies that show that weight loss or normal weight will reduce future disease. The thing that's different about these drugs is the weight loss that we experience with these drugs. If you stay on the drugs, the weight loss stays off. So the disease burden stays lower. And that's why ending yo-yo dieting is in the title of my book, The Ozempic Revolution, because yo-yo dieting is more detrimental to health. And we see it's not just saying that we're seeing the health benefits because of weight loss. We're seeing the health benefits because of weight loss and prolonged, sustainable, effective long-term weight loss.
All right, so now we've talked about the good stuff. Let's talk about potentially the bad stuff. Now, in the original clinical trials, and we've known from the get-go that some people are going to have, you know, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, you know, burping, all that kind of stuff. I'm not talking about that. We've known about that. You talk about that in the Ozempic Revolution, and you go through all that very well. What I want to know is, are there emerging concerns with the GLP-1s now that they've been on the market for a while and used, I mean, they've been on the market for a long time, but I mean, used in this kind of magnitude. What kinds of concerns are starting to pop up? Is there something people should know?
One of the things that I have my eye on right now is eye health. And I would say that generally the side effects are just byproducts of how the medication works and are very, very manageable and go away. As we have more and more and more, hundreds of thousands, millions of people more on these drugs, we will start to find potential links. The newest study looking at Nion, which is an arteritic ischemia in the eye, It's very, very small, but we need to study it more. This is not going to be seen widely in the population. It tends to be in patients who have type 2 diabetes and
I was going to
potentially
say,
with
yeah.
blood pressure that is not controlled. So I'm not going to be here and say blanket statement that these drugs have no risk. This is why not everybody should be on them, right? We still have to have this informed risk-benefit discussion. In the majority of cases, benefit outweighs risk, but it's just something to be aware of.
Yeah. There was also, I saw a thyroid warning recently that came across my desk. Anything about that?
So this has been studied extensively when it comes to thyroid health, because in the original studies there was some worry in rodent models that there potentially can be an upregulation of thyroid cancers. This is the only subset of people that we really don't write this for, is when they have a family history of MEN type 2 endocrine cancers or medullary thyroid
Yeah.
cancers, but it's not even proven in human population. I'm not really worried about this. But
Yeah.
again,
So
we will
stay tuned on
continue.
this one, getting more
Yeah.
data, but nothing to
No,
be
and we
concerned
will
about.
continue to monitor this. And again, these medications have been around in clinical use for over 20 years at this point. So we can feel
Yeah.
pretty good about their safety.
Let's talk about hair loss. There have been reports about hair loss, and postmenopause women have enough trouble keeping a decent amount of hair on their head. And we know that rapid changes in weight can cause a transient hair loss. So, number one, is this because of the weight loss? Do we know
Yes.
this? And is it transient?
So this is the same disease state that we experience postpartum hair loss, telogen effluvium, where your body has experienced a change in hormones and a state of life, and you will release and shed hair. We expect the hair to regrow. You bring up an excellent point, is that a lot of my patients are in this hairy postmenopausal era, and they are also experiencing thinning hair independent of weight loss. And with those patients, I will often say, hey, let's loop derm in and see if you're a good candidate for other medications that will help with maintaining and regrowth.
Yeah.
But when you keep up adequate protein intake and you don't lose weight too fast, and honestly are just aware that this will happen. Usually I see it about 30 to 40 pounds down. People will shed pretty dramatically. If you're aware of it, you don't panic, and you just kind of
Don't panic.
don't
That's the number
panic.
one thing. And I do have a couple of episodes, Hair Today, Gone Tomorrow, which goes through how to manage hair loss that's specifically because of what happens at menopause. So, anyone who's experiencing this should probably take a listen to those episodes because we're not going to go there right now. Okay, there was a recent analysis, a 2024 analysis that appeared in Lancet that looked at fat-free mass. And there were decreases of, big decreases, 25 to 39% of the total weight lost over a period of time. And so, in other words, it's not fat that's being lost. It's not just fat that's being lost. It's muscle. It's a lot of muscle. So, I mean, we know anyone that has substantial weight loss is going to lose some muscle. But what is your message? What do people need to know about this seemingly inevitable loss of some muscle mass?
Okay, so when we lose weight, we lose both fat and muscle. You are correct. There have been a lot of fear-mongering headlines that this medication causes muscle loss. No, this medication causes overall weight loss. When we look at the data, which I have dissected in the book so that you are informed, actually, the newer medications, the newer GLP-1 weekly medications, actually have superior muscle loss to dieting and calorie restriction alone. So that means that your ratio of muscle to fat loss is improved. We are going to continue to see even better ratios with the newer drugs coming to market. I will also say this is very modifiable. So if you focus on protein, not just not eating, which is the whole foundation, the food foundation in my book is how do we get adequate protein in? If you focus on protein and you focus on strength training, it doesn't have to be from day one of being on these medications, you will be able to really change and improve this ratio of muscle to fat loss and maintain your muscle. You can still build muscle while losing weight on GLP-1 medications.
Let's talk about the issue of getting enough protein, which you really talk about a lot and beautifully in the Ozempic Revolution. So I don't want to get into that too much specifically. But what I do want to ask you are your thoughts on these weekly protein shots that Nestle recently launched, really targeting the GLP-1 people. And I just have to say, I mean, all I kept thinking is, wait a minute. These are the people that make Kit Kat bars that are leading to all this obesity, and now they're launching protein bars to help people lose it. I mean, it's really a great business model. It's kind of like the person who their business is replacing cracked windshields, and they go around at night with a baseball bat, cracking people's windshields, and then leave their card on the car. I mean, so first of all, what are your thoughts on these, the product itself, and then of course that it's Nestle that's promoting this.
So I actually don't know if you know this about me, but I have real expertise and insight into this field because I actually am founder of a company that creates products for specifically GLP-1 users. So we
Okay.
play in the same space.
Yeah.
So I am seeing a lot of legacy brands like Nestle coming in, seeing big money signs coming in and saying, we're going to create products specifically for the GLP-1 user. But we're going to take old products that got us into this place, slap a label on it, and then call it a day and advertise it to GLP-1 users. And in this case specifically, this I actually wasn't even aware of this new product. You brought it to my attention. In this case, they're saying, take this drink. We're calling it a shot, which is so disingenuous because what do you think of when you're taking a shot? In this case, you think of the medication. Drink it before meals, and it might do something, and it might natively raise your GLP-1. Honestly, this is the same thing we're seeing with Kardashian brands like Lemme, who are saying, hey, take this supplement, it'll raise your native GLP-1. Raising your
And take away your
native
hot flashes while you're at it. Don't get me started.
raising your native GLP-1 doesn't actually do anything. We have medications that do this, and it doesn't do anything for weight loss. So
Yet another
I
example of why you should not get your medical education and recommendations from anyone whose last name is Kardashian.
I just we really have to be careful. What I'm seeing in the consumer market space is that a lot of people are jumping on this bandwagon, and it feels very reminiscent to me of when we went low carb and keto and everyone was trying to make products for this. Remember, the best way to eat when you're on these medications or for overall health is whole foods. We do need convenience in our life, and so it's okay to turn to specific products, but be a little skeptical, and especially if someone is promising you a non-medicated version of GLP-1, it's not going to work.
Yeah, and I love how in the Ozempic Revolution, you give menus, recipes, really trying to guide someone to success. Because I think what I took from the book, what I realized is I kind of thought, okay, you get your prescription, you get your shots, done, success. And that's not the case at all. It's really looking at this holistically, and it's a lifetime plan. And speaking of lifetime plan, could you talk a little bit about maintenance? Because that was really when they first came out was a big issue. This idea of you take this miracle drug that's going to make the pounds melt off, and then you stop the drug, and then not in every case, but in some cases, it's going to come back. So can you talk about what the current approach is to maintenance once someone has gotten to a healthy weight?
So, for the majority of people, maintenance will include staying on the dose of the medication that got you to that weight loss. This is what all clinical trials show. This is what we are seeing out in the real world. And we need to work hard and rewiring our thinking. On the media tour for the Ozempic Revolution, I continue to get this question where people think it's a big aha moment. Like, what do you mean you have to stay on this drug? And my answer is for any other disease, chronic disease, when we start someone on a medication and it's efficacious, we continue them on that medication.
Thyroid medication is a great, a great example. I mean,
Exactly.
because when estrogen, not everybody needs to stay on it forever. I will just say that. But when you're looking at something like thyroid, yeah, that's a lifetime commitment. Is it, so, but it surprises me it's the same dose. I thought that perhaps there was a
Well,
maintenance dose.
maintenance is usually the dose that we got you there. But I will say everyone is unique. And I lay this out in the Ozempic Revolution. Everyone needs to kind of understand how this works so that they can even advocate for themselves within their own doctor's offices. If you're losing beyond what is healthy, or you're comfortable with, or it does not achieving health, then we go down on the dose. For certain people, about 10, 5 to 10% of people, they are able to use this medication as a tool to take off weight, and they may be able to titrate down and eventually off. Usually, that's for people who put on weight very quickly, either due to being on a medication or potentially IVF treatment or post-pregnancy, and they were just
Right.
really not able to take it off, and they had been lean for the majority of their life. Or there was, I have a couple patients from COVID who very quickly put on significant weight, fat in COVID. We were able to use this as a tool to kind of get back to what they had been doing before, and they're able to unwind it. I will say, for the majority of people in my practice who are very concerned about staying on this medication long term, you know, we have a full informed discussion about that you may need to stay on this. And I do want you to understand that by the 6 month mark, the 12 month mark, they're saying, Dr. So, are you going to take this away from me? I love it. I love the way that I feel on this. And I'll, you know, and I'm like, no, like this is a
Okay, but are
conversation.
insurance companies on board with this? This is an expensive drug. Are they going to let someone who is now at a normal, healthy weight, who has no objective metabolic issues, stay on this drug for the next 30 years?
Well,
I don't
if
know.
your insurance covers the medication, they should be using your original starting BMI as ongoing
All right.
evidence.
So while we're on that topic, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do think we have to give at least a nod to the idea of compounded GLP-1s, because when the compounded versions came out, it was because they couldn't make it fast enough to keep up with it. And it was really the only way. And now I don't think that that's as much of an issue. I think that they are making a lot of products so that you can get the commercial stuff, but the compounded stuff is dramatically less expensive. So, what are your thoughts on compounded? When is it okay to use a compounded version, and when is it not okay?
I
And
will
is it
say
ever okay?
the official statement from the Obesity Medicine Association
Oh, I know
is
that.
that we should not be turning to compounded
I know that. I
medications.
want to know what you say. Realistically, you have a patient who comes in, it's not covered by her insurance, and she has found a really well-regulated, trusted compounder, not some sleazy, fly-by-night internet something. What do you tell her?
I go through in the book, The Ozempic Revolution, I go through the kind of checklist of what you need to do when you're working with a compounded pharmacy because I am aware that people are using these. I will say, I don't actually think it's that much less expensive. If you were to go and work with an obesity medicine specialist, we understand how to sometimes break up these medications and dose them differently so that they're more affordable to you. The pharmaceutical companies really need to get their act together. These medications are $100 to $200 in Europe. They should be coming down here. I really wish this wasn't a discussion we had to have because the problem with compounding pharmacies is I love them. I use them for other medications. But when it comes to this medication, it's not off patent. So we don't really know what you're getting, and we really can't validate what they're creating. It is complicated to make this drug. Bigger than that, the bigger problem I see here is that many places that are giving out compounding pharmacies, we see the ads all over our social media feeds. They are not providing good care, comprehensive care. They are not treating you from the lens of metabolic health and long-term health. In addition to that, I am starting to see crazy things where they are creating new medications that are not even FDA approved. So they're
Right.
saying, oh, you could
Which,
take a
right, that's
pill for this or a patch for this. I mean, we have to be careful. We really don't know. I don't even know what that is.
Right. I mean,
So,
and we run into the same thing with compounded hormone stuff too, is that if you are working with a compounder who you know, who you trust, you still have concerns because you still are depending on, what they put in it. I would say it's the difference between store-bought cookies and homemade cookies, that you don't really know what's necessarily in every homemade cookie. It's going to change a little bit, and the store-bought, you know what you're getting. So I hear you loud and clear. I agree with you overall, but I think it is important for folks to know who are depending on compounded that there's the probably okay compounded, and there's the, oh my God, do not take this
I
compounded.
think if you're having very weird side, if you're having side effects, if you're not seeing efficacy, I think you really do need to question what you're
Yeah.
getting. I have had patients come to me saying, I was on compounded and I lost nothing. That says to me, when we put them on the FDA approved version, they were not actually getting the
Weren't
medication. And
getting
this
the
has
real
been
deal,
shown by
so to speak.
independent studies. So I think, you know, if you're feeling well and you're comfortable with it, great. And again, by the Ozempic revolution, so you know how to advocate for your own overall metabolic health and not just use the
You know what
medication.
questions to ask. So you threw something out there that I think is an important point, and you mentioned obesity specialists. And this is something, again, in my world, we run into a lot. Do you go to your regular gynecologist who spends 90% of their time delivering babies and get your hormone therapy from this person who really doesn't know that much about it? Or do you see a menopause specialist? So, in your world, if someone is interested in a GLP-1, do you think it's okay that they get a prescription from their general doctor, their internist, their family practice doctor? They need to see someone who's certified in obesity medicine. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely, it's okay. It's really okay to get this medication wherever you are able to get it. I am so happy that weight stigma has started to break down to the point that cardiologists and nephrologists and primary care doctors are saying, hey, I see benefit in this, and I'm not just telling you to eat less and exercise more. With that, I will say that it's complicated to write these medications. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book was that it's impossible in the traditional doctor's visit to give comprehensive education around these medications on how to think and how to eat and how to exercise and all of the things that go into successful long-term weight management. So there's a little bit more work that needs to be done on your part. I will also say the complicating factor about going to a non-specialist is that they often don't know how to do prior authorizations, or they refuse to. Their offices is already overrun as it is. It's not their fault. It's a fault of the insurance system. So sometimes I'll have patients who come to me who are paying extraordinary amounts of money out of pocket. They got the prescription elsewhere, and no one had ever checked their prior authorization status or if insurance were to cover it. So again, learning how to advocate for yourself in that and knowing what your insurance covers is important. And then the third arm of that is that if you go to a generalist and you say, am I a candidate for these medications? And they say, absolutely not, or they're unsafe, or you'll never get off of them. Please just smile and walk out and hand them a copy of my book. I get a
Exactly.
lot of that too.
Yeah.
So I think you can
I
get it
think the bottom
anywhere.
line message here is it's not important to see an obesity specialist. It's important to read the Ozempic revolution so that you know what to look for, you know what questions to ask. And most important is that you have a holistic approach to all of this, and then you can advocate for yourself if whoever is treating you is really not looking at it from a holistic point
And
of
then you
view.
go to your friendly obesity med specialist. I mean, really, they are the best at this, but we cannot treat the entirety of the United States with the
No.
10,000 doctors that have the specialty training. It's
Well, that's
impossible.
exactly it. And again, I'm going to say vagina a second time, but when people are having problems with vaginal pain and dryness, and I tell them, listen, if your regular doctor gives you something and it works for you, great. You don't have to see anyone else. But if they give you the product, whatever it is, local vaginal estrogen or DHEA, and you're still having pain, it's time to get yourself to someone who has more expertise. And I think that that's the same theme that we have in your world. If you are seeing a doctor who writes this prescription and you are reaching your goals and you're feeling good and everything is going well, then great, great. But if not, just know that there are specialists out there who know the nuances and can really look at this in using a little bit better lens, if you will. So I've really enjoyed this conversation. I've learned a lot. I have to tell you, I was hesitant to do this segment, this episode, because I did one not too long ago. But now after talking to you, I'm so glad we did, because we didn't cover any of this in the other episode. We really spent more time talking about, the basics of how it works and how to take it. And I think that this really is a wonderful complement to the episode I did a few months ago. So thank you so much. I know you're busy book touring and all over the place. And so I appreciate your taking this time. And do you have any last thoughts before we end?
I just appreciate the work you're doing, and we're very similar plights here. We're really trying to break down stigma and change the way that we treat people. So I'm just so fortunate to be able to spread the word.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the work that you do.